Welcome to Public Policy This Week, a well-rounded weekly discussion of policy issues that frame today's American experience.
Good morning. It is Friday, December 23rd, and you've joined us for Public Policy This Week here on KYMN Radio. Public Policy This Week is dedicated to the honest and open discussion of public policy issues. Each week, we take a look at specific policy subjects, and we have guests on the show that are experts in their field. I'm Rich Larson, and partnering with me today is my dear friend, Joe Moravchik.
James Madison was the primary author of the Bill of Rights, ratified in 1791. Included is, of course, the First Amendment, which has two provisions concerning religion, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. The Establishment Clause prohibits the government from establishing a religion, and the Free Exercise Clause protects a citizen's right to freely practice their religion. We're a country premised upon a separation of church and state. However, politics is now, and from our founding, has been intertwined with religion. Today on Public Policy This Week, we are going to discuss the intersection of politics and religion and the content and impact of religious communication in politics. Our guest joining us in the studio is Chris Chapp, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Olaf College. Professor Chapp teaches classes on American politics and research methodology courses with titles such as American Politics, Media and American Politics, Analyzing Politics, and Political Parties and Elections. In addition to teaching, Professor Chapp's primary research interests involve voting behavior and electoral campaigns in the United States, political psychology and public opinion, political campaign communication, inequality, religion and politics, and methods of research.
And he plays guitars in the world's greatest unknown rock band. And if he wasn't busy enough, Chris was named in July of this year as the Morrison Family Director of the Institute for Freedom and Community at St. Olaf College. We'll ask him more about that appointment later in the program. Chris received his PhD from the University of Minnesota in 2008. Before that, he completed his undergraduate degree from the University of Wisconsin. Great. I am surrounded by Badgers. That's just wonderful.
Yeah, there's more coming on that.
Yeah.
Rich.
Wisconsin. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I get that. Sky Uma. There we go. Chris is the author of a book titled Religious Rhetoric in American Politics, The Endurance of Civil Religion and Electoral Campaigns. He is currently working on a second book with Paul Gorin from the University of Minnesota on the politics of abortion and LGBT rights due out in 2023. When not teaching or researching political science topics, Chris enjoys spending time with his family at Northern Lake Cabin, watching college football, woodworking, and powerlifting.
Professor Chris Chapp, welcome to Public Policy This Week on KYMN Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Chris, where did you grow up?
I grew up all over the place, mostly in Wisconsin, though.
Mostly area. Okay, yeah. So yeah, you are a Badger through and through then.
I certainly am.
And we know that Joe is. Okay. Well, all right.
And that cabin's on the Wisconsin side of the border, so I've still got 1 foot in the state.
My family has a cabin in Wisconsin also. It's to my utter and complete shame, but whatever.
Nobody's perfect.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, let's get into our discussion. Chris, what is faith? What is religion? How does a political scientist like yourself think about religion? How do you think about religion in the context of politics?
Yeah, it's a great question to start with. And theologians might split hairs with some of these answers, but when political scientists talk about faith, usually what we're talking about is an individual experience, mm-hmm. someone's own personal relationship with God, for example. And when we talk about religion, that's sort of a collective faith. Faith in, a bunch of people that have faith in the same deity. Now, in the context of politics, this is really interesting. And social scientists usually break down religion into three categories, each which is important to American politics in different ways. And we sometimes call these the three Bs, belonging, belief, and behavior. Belonging is probably what most people think of first. Oftentimes, it could be belonging in a particular denominational tradition, so Lutheran or Catholic or Jewish or whatever. By belief, usually what we're talking about are the different sort of theologically held beliefs that people have. It could mean other things as well, a particular image of God. Do you think of God as paternal or maternal? Mm-hmm. These are beliefs mm-hmm. that can actually impact politics in some really interesting ways. And then by behavior, what we mean is the types of things that you do. Worship attendance being sort of the most classic, but even daily prayer before a meal, these are religious behaviors that actually can have important political implications. And you can imagine different ways that this might play out. Someone might have been raised in a religious tradition where members of that tradition typically vote for Republicans or vote for Democrats. And this might be because of sort of ethno-religious allegiances to a particular party, or it might be because of beliefs. So, for example, people with more authoritative understandings of what God is versus more benevolent understandings of God actually have very different-looking political attitudes. Or it could be from cues that one gets from clergy on Sunday. Mm-hmm. Even though there's prohibitions about what clergy can and can't say about politics, if you attend regularly, this gets to the behavior aspect. If you attend regularly, you might be more exposed to these cues, and that might shape your political thinking. So these varied conceptualizations of religion, behavior, belief, belonging, can impact politics in a lot of different ways, and political scientists argue about sort of what matters the most and what's the most important.
So what is civil religion, and how is it distinct from religion in a more traditionally defined way? And then what are examples of civil religion?
Yeah, so civil religion is really interesting. It's what I wrote my first book on. And I think to talk about civil religion, it's helpful to think about what makes America unique in some ways. The United States has a really high degree of religious pluralism. Mm-hmm. When you think about, how many different denominations and religious traditions have a foothold in the U.S. We also have really high rates of religious adherence. We'll talk about this more later. It's going down in some way, in some ways, but compared to other nations, the U.S. still has really high rates of religious adherence. So for a civic leader, this creates a little bit of a challenge, right? How do you appeal to a single religious group? You can't. At least not without alienating other religious groups. And this is where this idea of civil religion comes in. So when we talk about civil religion, it's not, an official church that people attend on Sunday. The idea is that there are implicit religious values that a nation holds, and that Americans are united by some sort of quasi-religious common creed. It's not a denominational creed. It's not based in the Bible. And in fact, some refer to civil religion as a minimal monotheism. Right? It's very, very basic beliefs. In the American case, it's often thought of as sort of a unique moral calling. Have you heard the phrase city on a hill?
Absolutely. Yeah. President Reagan. Yeah.
Well, President Reagan, it actually goes back to 1630. Yes. John Winthrop, right, a Puritan preacher on the Arabella, visiting the New World for the first time. And so it's hundreds of years old, popularized by Reagan. Right. Obama used it as well, and a number of and this idea of a shining city on a hill, that America is going to be sort of the moral compass for the world in some way, shape, or form. It's a controversial idea, but this really epitomizes what's meant by civil religion. It expresses itself in different ways. So we have, religious phrases on our currency. It's very rare to find a politician. Again, even though we have an establishment clause and a free exercise clause, it's very unusual to hear a political speech that doesn't end with something like God bless America or God bless our troops. And so when we talk about civil religion, I'm not going to, argue that it's a good thing or that it's a bad thing. And in fact, there's all sorts of arguments for and against the existence of civil religion at a normative level. Is this something we should have? But I would assert it's something that we do have, right? It's really prevalent in American politics, and that it has important functions, whether you think it's a good thing or not. such as engendering some sense of common identity or being a moral compass, a moral benchmark to which Americans can reflect and criticize ourselves.
Hmm. I'm sitting here thinking about how strange it would feel to watch a State of the Union address and not, if the president were to not say at the end, God bless America, it would feel, the speech would feel unfinished. That's just what we've always heard.
Yeah, and I think it would strike voters really as pretty odd as well.
It would.
That State of the Union address, when you think about the majesty, it almost has sort of a procession as the president enters. It has almost a quasi-religious feel to it.
Yes, it does.
It's also why I think when we break those norms, and you've heard, you know, examples in recent years about, you know, people shouting during a State of the Union or something like that, I think why violating those norms is often seen as, you know, dare I say, sacrilegious in some ways.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited to have this conversation with you today. As a student of political science, I've talked to people who have told me that they're not real strong people of faith, but politics sort of fills that. They feel like politics can fill that void for them a little, or not the void, but that space for them. And so, Chris, in your estimation then, this is the crux of the whole show right here. How does religion impact politics? And then how does politics impact religion?
Yeah, it's a huge question. So I'll try to unpack it a little bit, and then we can do follow-ups if you want.
Yeah.
I mean, the first thing I would say is it depends, again, on what you mean by religion. Because as I said with this sort of three B's approach, we can think about, you know, clergy cues impacting religion. We can think about deep-seated belief systems impacting religion. So I needed to put that caveat out there. The traditional view is that religion is rooted in these sort of fundamental bedrock beliefs. And it's pretty unshakable and pretty stable over one's life. So you can imagine you are born into a particular religious tradition. You learn that tradition from your parents. And in fact, parent-to-child transmission of religious identity is really, really common. You know, the best way to figure out what somebody's, you know, personal faith is to ask their parents what your faith is. So, so parent-to-child religious socialization is very common. And then you learn these fundamental worldviews through social learning, through going to Sunday school or going to worship services or whatever. And then this gives rise to a worldview that is, again, pretty unshakable and influences one's politics down the road because you have certain values or whatever. So that's the traditional view. In recent years in the social sciences, a number of scholars, myself included, have started to push back at this a little bit. And there's different versions of the argument, but the basic point here is that first off, religious worldviews, religious values, even, you know, traditional membership in a denomination, it's not as unshakable as is often assumed. So people do hop from one religion to another or disidentify or whatever. So and people's religious beliefs and practices change over the course of their life as well. It's still really strong. But it's not as strong as was often assumed. Another observation is that some political attitudes are really, really stable and really, really enduring. Partisanship is one of those stable and enduring attitudes. Rich, when you were talking about, you know, how politics sort of fills that void, right? For some folks, a partisan identity is way more stable and way more enduring and way more central to who they are as a person than a religious identity. And so the other thing that I would say matters is attitudes on political issues. And again, the traditional view is always that religion sort of comes first and it influences all these downstream choices, like how you feel about, you know, immigration or gun rights or taxes or abortion. My co-author Paul Gorin and I have questioned this view, and we have found that, in fact, attitudes toward abortion and attitudes toward LGBT rights are actually really, really stable over time, and are predictive of changes in religious identity later in life. So translation, people's attitudes on abortion are changing their patterns of religious affiliation and religious practices and so on and so forth.
Chris, define secularism for our audience. Is American society becoming a more secular society? Is there a disaffiliation from organized religious institutions taking place? There seems to be and has been for decades. If so, why is that? Perhaps it's a decline in institutional trust. How is that affecting politics and religion's influence on politics?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you answered part of it already in asking the question, that we see trust in all sorts of institutions going down across the board, whether we're talking about media as an institution, as we sit here on the radio, whether we're talking about religious institutions, law enforcement, government. I mean, so there's institutional trust almost across the board is decreasing. When we talk about secularism, what we're talking about is a movement away from religion. Scholars talk about this in different ways. Sometimes you know a rise in people that are atheist or agnostic in their beliefs. Another way that you see this talked about and characterized, and what I like to focus on, is what you might call the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. So these are folks that just don't identify with a particular religious tradition. It doesn't mean that they're atheist or agnostic or completely devoid of faith, but certainly don't have a strong loyalty to any particular religious tradition. The percentage of Americans that identify as none has been increasing fairly dramatically over the last 30 years. It's more prominent in some traditions than others, but it's really across the board. It's more common disaffiliation among younger folks, but it's actually going on everywhere. And back to my research with Paul Gorin, we think this is connected in some ways to politics. Politics have turned some folks off of religion. A lot of Americans don't like that intermingling. They see politics and religion as too closely bound, and for that reason, some Americans, because of politics, some have become even more strongly identified with a particular mm-hmm. religious community. Mm-hmm. But the movement in the other direction has been even stronger.
Well, Chris, certainly one of your interests is research methodology. So let's talk about that for a minute. How do you analyze your topics of interest and study, such as public opinion and voting behavior?
Yeah. And I mean, I'm glad you asked this, because sort of as I sit here and make these claims about, you know, the percentage of Americans who identify or don't identify and what's happening with voting behavior, it's helpful to talk a little bit about how we come to these conclusions. So, you know, as a practical matter, I rely a lot on surveys. This is what I teach my students as well. So, looking at big public opinion surveys, some of these surveys are collected by other research institutions, but we're talking sometimes 40, 50,000 voters. So really big cross samples of the American public. Usually quite a bit larger than the polling that you see, like horse race polling around elections and things like that. Mm-hmm. So rely a lot on surveys. We're going to talk about political communication, I think, a little bit later. And I use text as data. So there's ways to take, whether it's Twitter feeds or campaign websites or political speeches or newspaper articles, take all these words that are out there and look at patterns over time and try to figure out how political rhetoric is changing. So those are the two big tools that I use. One big thing is transparency. It's really important when we're doing this work that we're really clear about how we sample the public. There's a lot of controversy around surveys these days and who's getting sampled and who's not.
Absolutely.
So try to be really, really clear about, how we reach how we reach voters. For students, I really emphasize when I'm teaching this, emphasize things like replicability. Could somebody else have run this exact same study and come to the same conclusion? So you got to be really, really clear about what we did. And then when people disagree, you know, they can maybe disagree with the approach and say, well, I don't like the way you ran that sample, or I don't like the way you analyzed these groups, or the way you asked this question about abortion. But at least then that's where the disagreement's at. And I also think it's important to note, you know, it's, I call myself a political scientist. Sometimes people don't put the word science with politics, right. but I do. We form hypotheses and try to go out in the world and test them. And one thing about science and scientific knowledge is that it's a process, and it's open to revision. And so that's a really big part of what I do, is trying to learn things and be sort of self-critical, mm-hmm. and ask how things might look different 5-10 years from now.
Right. Well, there's the phrase, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics, right? And I as a poli sci student, I always sort of took a little bit of offense to that, because I mean it does, and it's always attributed to political surveys and things, but and frankly the media also, which I'm going to be offended all over the place on that, but it does sort of leave out the fact that there really is an interest in this. There's in political science, there's anthropology, there's sociology, and that's what we're talking about as much as anything.
We live in a world today where there is more information at our fingertips mm-hmm. than ever before. And so I think, one thing that we need to do as consumers of political information, mm-hmm. as responsible consumers of political mm-hmm. information, is to, this is going to sound very self-aggrandizing because it's what I teach, but I think we all need to have a little bit of research methods training to understand, okay, how was this collected? What are the critical questions that I should be asking about this claim that just got made in a public policy debate? How can I scrutinize this information so that I can go out into the world and make intelligent choices?
Right. For our listeners, you're listening to Public Policy This Week on KYMN Radio in beautiful downtown Northfield, Minnesota. I'm Rich Larson, alongside Jill Moravchik, and we're talking with Professor Chris Chapp of St. Olaf College about the relationship between politics and religion.
Chris, let's transition to political rhetoric. Preparing for the show, I was thinking about presidential candidates and their oratory abilities, or lack thereof. Presidents Kennedy, Reagan, and Obama immediately come to mind as highly skilled public speakers. And I also thought about great speeches that really resonated with people or have lasted the test of time in the context of our topic today. I reread Lincoln's 1864 address at Gettysburg to honor Union soldiers that died in battle, dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. In that address, Lincoln remarks, "These dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth." It's beautiful prose. And to think about his remarks, he said, "The world will little note nor long remember what we say here." One of the events of my lifetime that I remember, Rich, perhaps you remember this distinctly mm-hmm. too, is when the Challenger space shuttle broke apart in January of 1986. Mm-hmm. I was a college student, and we were watching that launch live. It was certainly a distressing national event. What I remember most about that event was President Reagan's address to the nation about it, his eloquence, his genuineness, the beauty of his words. In that address, he said, "The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us by the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them this morning as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of earth to touch the face of God." And of course, foundational to President Reagan's political career was his belief that God intended America to be a beacon of hope, faith, freedom, and democracy, as you mentioned earlier, that city on a hill. First, how common is religious rhetoric as a regular part of how candidates communicate with voters? Second question, do citizens, or perhaps what percentage of citizens, base their decisions about candidates on their expressed religious beliefs and values? And third, are there any political addresses with religious rhetoric or that invoke God that you have found to be particularly effective? That's a long series of questions.
Yeah. Let me try to take them in order. How common is religious rhetoric as a regular part of how candidates communicate? The short answer is it's very common. Yeah. And the passages that you just read are really, they harken back to what we talked about before. They're classic civil religion. There's no particular religious subgroup that gets mentioned. Reagan's not calling out a particular faith tradition, not mentioning Christianity, not mentioning, you know, a denomination, not mentioning a religious interest group, you know, Focus on the Family or something like that. Really trying to appeal to as many voters as possible. So it's classic civil religion. In fact, some scholars have referred to presidents as the high priests of the American civil religion. And you can see how, these are great examples. I think we could also probably recall George W. Bush on 9/11, making some of these same sort of invocations.
That speech W. made with the bullhorn from Ground Zero is the one that immediately comes to mind, where he was speaking off the cuff, but there was all kinds of religious rhetoric in just what he was saying right there. Anyway, I don't mean to interrupt you. I apologize.
No. I think it's a great example, and the fact that you could just sort of vividly recall it.
Yeah.
It kind of gets to an answer to the second part of the question, which is do citizens vote based on this stuff? And the answer to that, I think, is a little bit more complicated. You know, we have this sort of prohibition of too much religion in politics that's sort of normatively built into the American ethos in some way. We don't want too much. Most Americans don't want too much intermingling there. But at the same time, we also have expectations of candidates and want candidates who we share identity with and who represent us in some way. And so civil religion, this minimal monotheism, is one way that the candidates can make that appeal. And that's not to say that in these moments of national tragedy, this isn't genuine either, because I think for a lot of candidates, it is genuine. I'm not cynical about that. But I also think that it does matter for voters. It has this sort of representative function in some ways. So this is what I showed in our first book. We did a lot of things, but in particular, used experiments where I would kind of create these fake candidate profiles and have voters look at different passages, some of which use these really almost banal religious references, not in the context of a national tragedy like these examples, but just in sort of advocacy for a policy position. And sure enough, religious cues like this made people much more favorable, not to all voters, non-believers. It did not resonate with in the same way, as well as folks from marginalized religious traditions in the U.S. These civil religion cues didn't work in quite the same way. But in general, this is probably a win. You know, again, not to reduce these moments to strategy, but it's probably a winning strategy for most candidates most of the time.
Yeah. I think it's Maya Angelou who said people will forget what you say, but they won't forget how you made them feel.
Yeah.
And I've always attached that to romance in political speech. And that's just got to play right to exactly what you're talking about, isn't it? That religion is something that's so deeply held. Mm-hmm. It's such an important part of a lot of people's personalities that when you appeal to that, or when you just even mention it, right? Isn't that just, it is a little cynical to call it strategy, but that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, it evokes that emotion, and ultimately, you know, candidates want you to like them and to feel like you're one of them, right? And this is one way that you can communicate that as a candidate.
Yeah.
In a review, or perhaps it was a summary of your book titled Religious Rhetoric in American Politics, The Endurance of Civil Religion in an Electoral Campaigns, I read that effective religious rhetoric is characterized by two factors, emotive cues and invocations of collective identity. And these factors regularly shape the outcomes of American presidential elections and the dynamics of political representation. While we tend to think that certain issues are invoked to appeal to specific religious constituencies who vote solely on such issues, Professor Chapp shows us that religious rhetoric is often more encompassing and less issue-specific. So that's the summary. What does it all mean? Please start first with identity and emotive rhetoric.
Yeah, so the question that I was asking when I was looking at civil religion is specifically, you know, if this genre works, why does it work? What are the common elements? And because you know, Obama and George W. Bush, two very different candidates, are both using, you know, invoking these the genre in really in the same way. So I wanted to ask, you know, what's the common denominator? And identity and emotion are the two big things. So starting with identity, my background is political psychology. Mm-hmm. And in political psychology, we talk a lot about social identities. We all have them. Social identities are how we organize the social world. Yeah, and you can think about anything from, Northfield Raiders to Badgers versus Gophers or whatever, right? These social and of course religion, race, and so on and so forth. And so social identities can be a force to unite people, but they can also be a source of conflict. Mm-hmm. And I think we could all easily think of examples of intergroup conflict that have arisen over these conflicting groups, conflicting identities. And so a question that social psychologists have been asking, well, forever, I guess, is what can you do to resolve these intergroup conflicts? One thing that you can do is you could try to make the groups less salient, right? Try to not get me to think of myself as a Wisconsin Badger fan, right? When I'm in this studio. But that doesn't usually work, right? It's pretty tough to get people to not think of themselves as a group member. Another thing that you can do, though, that does work is you create a new group, right? A broader, overarching, common group identity that can unite people. And what I argue in the book is that civil religion plays this role. Not for everybody. It's not for everybody. But for a lot of voters, they can have this sort of shared kind of quasi-religious experience watching a particular candidate talk, even though those voters are coming from really radically different faith traditions. Mm-hmm. Because this civil religion can be this kind of common glue. So that's identity. Mm-hmm. And the other thing Rich already alluded to is emotion. Emotions often are disparaged, right? We often elevate sort of reason over emotion. That's kind of the Enlightenment view of how we're supposed to think about politics. It's also totally unrealistic, right? Nobody, and even the person, I would always be very suspicious of mm-hmm. anybody who says that there are sort of all reason, no emotion, because mm-hmm. the fact of the matter is emotions guide decision-making in ways that we don't even realize. And civil religion lends itself to emotive rhetoric and emotion and an emotional experience. Usually it's very positive. The emotion of enthusiasm is one that I found is really, really commonly wedded to American civil religion. But it can also be, it could also create fear or anger depending on how it's invoked.
Would you equate this idea of identity politics to tribalism, or is it a little more, I don't know, not quite as deeply rooted as someone the need to belong to a group? Where do you think it's somewhere in between there, or is it that deep?
I think you hit the nail on the head. My friend and colleague Liliana Mason wrote this book. And I really think that the title says it all. It's called Uncivil Agreement.
Okay.
And the premise of the book is we actually agree on quite a bit. There is a fairly high degree of public policy consensus on a lot of issues. If you really peel back the layers,
That's been the fundamental tenet of American democracy forever. We argue about all kinds of things, but deep down, we pretty much agree on more than we disagree on.
Yeah, but uncivil agreement. So What Mason says is that despite these public policy agreements, if we could ever get there, right, deep down, it's conflict over sort of, you know, my party beating your party.
Yep.
And it's uncivil. It's, in American politics, we hear the phrase negative partisanship a lot, which goes back to this idea. We talked about the decay of institutions that in some ways includes party institutions. The number of people who identify as independent is actually on the rise, which at first blush seems to be in tension with the idea that we're sorting ourselves in these two partisan tribes. But in fact, what's happening is that you might identify as independent. Maybe you lean one way or another, but you really, really, really don't like the other guys. Right? So, I think, yeah, Rich, I'll agree completely with the premise of the question there.
Okay.
I didn't see President Kennedy as a particularly devout Catholic, but as he ran as a candidate for president in 1960, he did experience anti-Catholic bias based on the idea that a Catholic president might have dual loyalties to country and the Vatican. Kennedy famously remarked, "Contrary to common newspaper usage, I am not the Catholic candidate for president. I am the Democratic Party's candidate for president, who happens to also be Catholic. I do not speak for my church on public matters, and the church does not speak for me." Does religious rhetoric welcome religious difference and encourage pluralism, coexistence? Or is religious rhetoric more used to divide? Perhaps it is both and candidate dependent.
Yeah, I think it's both. We've been talking a lot about this genre of civil religion, and the way I framed it is it's mostly used as a force to unite. That doesn't mean it doesn't contain divisive undercurrents, though. There are certainly people that hear "God bless our troops" and really get turned off by that. So I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush, although I think generally that's at least the aim of that particular genre. It's also important to mention, though, that there's other ways that candidates use religion in their speech. I think it's less common. But I think about some of Trump's rhetoric, for example, which was very different. Trump used some civil religion, but he also did things like include explicit appeals to Christian groups, and at times derogated minority religious traditions. This is a really hard break with the civil religion tradition in some important ways. And it's certainly not the first time that we saw religious outgroup appeals. It didn't start with Trump. Historically, there have been lots of attacks on candidates from minority religious traditions. You mentioned Kennedy, but we could talk about Al Smith in 1928.
Right, yeah, right.
We could talk about Obama in 2008, and there were false accusations that he was a Muslim, which, you know, A, shouldn't matter, and B, wasn't true. There was the Jeremiah Wright controversy surrounding Obama. So,
well, there was just the focus on his middle name, Hussein, too.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So, which I would say is probably rooted in a degree of religious prejudice. And so, so these types of attacks have been. I mean, Thomas Jefferson was called an atheist, right? So there were these types of attacks have been around forever. Civil religion is not the only genre out there. We started today, Joe, but you mentioned the Establishment Clause, right? So there are no religious tests for holding office. But at the end of the day, in the privacy of a ballot box, right, voters can do whatever they want. And when you look at some of the public opinion data out there, voters, for example, are still very skeptical of a candidate who would run as say, an atheist. A strong majority say that would make them less likely to vote for that candidate. So I think there's ways that religion can still be really divisive. But, you know, all this against this backdrop of civil religion, it is still, I would argue, kind of the most common genre out there that the candidates deploy when they are when they're talking with voters.
It really is interesting, the idea that it's a divisive thing, just based on the idea that, like exactly what you said, if the next major candidate for president came out and said, "I do not believe in God," what are the odds that that person gets elected president in this country? I mean, those odds plummet,
yeah.
Don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you're right, though. There is a divisiveness to it. Chris, does one political party have monopoly control over religiosity and religious rhetoric and dialogue? I can remember growing up, I used to, and I don't know, well, I think it's probably because the Kennedys were Catholics, but I had it in my head that Catholics are Democrats and Protestants are Republicans, which is completely not true. My dear friend, Mr. Muravchik, a perfect example of that. In your research experience, do both parties use religiosity and religious rhetoric and dialogue to direct conversation and influence voters? Or in contrast, is one party more secular in its rhetoric and its dialogue?
Yeah, so let me answer the question in a couple of different ways.
Yeah.
Because we started talking about voters, not rhetoric. And in terms of voting behavior, there are some pretty clear patterns in the electorate. Folks who are not affiliated with any particular church vote for Democrats. Mm-hmm. Folks who identify with one of the evangelical traditions much more likely to go Republican. I mean, it's sometimes called the God gap. Mm-hmm. So in terms of kind of the public opinion dynamics and the party coalitions, there absolutely is a really interesting divide there. It's not denominational in the same way that it once was.
Right.
And in fact, scholars argue that started to change really in the late 80s, early 90s, when you started to see coalitions being formed across traditions mm-hmm. for political power. An evangelical like Jerry Falwell and a conservative Catholic, Paul Weyrich, mm-hmm. might join forces to enact a policy agenda mm-hmm. Or to press for a policy agenda. That became a really important part of the Republican coalition. And more recently, we've seen the same thing happening with Democrats and folks who don't identify with any particular tradition. That presents a challenge for Democrats, by the way, because, you know, a church as a location can be a place where organizing can happen. But if you're not attending church, there is no location for organizing
right.
to happen.
So I
think that those divisions are really real. And I don't see them going away anytime soon. Now, in terms of does one party have a monopoly on religious rhetoric or religious language, I would say no. So when I look at civil religion, across the last 30 years or so in my book, I went back to 1980, there's no real partisan trend. Both parties, presidential candidates, mm-hmm. at least from both parties, are equally likely to use that sort of civil religion genre. And so I don't see like partisan ownership of that particular type of religiosity. I'll tell you about a project I did with some of my students, or actually I've been doing for quite some time with my students, is we always go through and we're really interested in House candidates. I'm interested in House elections.
Mm-hmm.
And so since 2008, we've been scraping the website for every single House candidate, Republican and Democrat, for all of their content, all of their issues, their bio, everything.
You're a busy man.
It's a huge data set now. We've got thousands upon thousands upon thousands of candidates' information stored. And I just took a look after 2022 to see. I looked at some basic religious words, God, prayer, you know, so on and so forth, mm-hmm. to see, you know, how often these terms were coming up. Republicans have are using religious words at a slightly higher rate. It's about 52% of Republican candidates mm-hmm. in 2022. About 42% of Democratic candidates. So there's a little bit of a gap there. I think a lot of that probably goes back to the districts that they're appealing to mm-hmm. as well and what voters want to hear. So there's a little bit of a gap in religious language, but it's not as prominent as you might suspect. So I would say that the gap is very real in the world of public opinion, but I would also say both Democratic and Republican candidates are still trying to make these religious appeals.
Well, okay, so then to that point, researching politicians' use of religious rhetoric and its effect on the public, you have no doubt also investigated considerations influencing the decision process of a politician to use religious rhetoric in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. What factors are a part of the decision process to use religious rhetoric? And I guess I'm tempted to add, how cynical are our political candidates when it comes to that, this kind of a thing? But that might be a little more proselytizing than I should throw in there. So
no, I think it's important. When I study this stuff, I try to get a list of variables that I can use to predict when this is going to go up. And one thing that is just not measurable is, you know, is this genuine
yes.
or not?
Yes.
And so it's tough for me to speak to that.
Yeah.
What I would say is this. When we're talking about presidential candidates, you need to use the civil religion genre. Almost every presidential candidate has done so in the last 30 years, which is what I've studied. So at the presidential level, and you can think about it, you know, at the presidential level, it's the most diverse coalition you're going to get, right? You're trying to appeal to all sorts of voters across the country. And so it's really important that candidates invoke this. When I look at House races, other things that are important. So candidates are, there's a saying in political science, candidates are single-minded seekers of re-election.
Yes.
And so that's sort of my framework going into this.
Thus your interest in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so the first thing I'm going to look at is what does the district look like? Who are the constituents? Sure. Is it a religious district or not? Obviously, we're going to see more of this. And in fact, in certain districts where you might see like a lot of, for example, evangelical Christians, a candidate might be able to break away from the civil religion genre and use something that more of a specific subgroup appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing I would do is look at the district. Like I said, I think there are some differences in party coalitions as well. And so that party's probably going to make a difference in what kind of religious language candidates are using. Another thing that's really important, in political science, we use the phrase candidate dialogue. Are the campaigns talking to each other? And at one level, this is important just, you know, to have a meaningful public policy conversation. Mm-hmm. We kind of hope that they're talking about the same issues. But it's also important because you need to press back against attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So, another predictor, if you will, of what candidates are saying is probably what's their opponent saying. And the final thing I would say is just, you know, the overall risk environment. I think at some level, when we talk about House races, using religious rhetoric can be a risky strategy. It can alienate some voters. It can embolden others. I would say that it is probably more likely for non-incumbents, for challengers running in some of these sort of long shot districts, use religious rhetoric because you need to.
Folks, you're listening to Public Policy This Week on KYMN Radio, AM 1080, FM 95.1, broadcasting from Northfield, Minnesota. My name is Rich Larson. Alongside myself is my co-host, Jill Moravchik. We're talking with Professor Chris Chapp of St. Olaf College about the relationship between politics and religion.
Chris, the midterm elections just concluded in November. Did you have your students engaged in any type of political research during this campaign season? If so, did that research have any notable conclusions, perhaps associated with what we are discussing today, or other general conclusions about why the electorate voted as they did, the issues or rhetoric that made the difference in this election cycle?
Yes, I need to brag about my St. Olaf students because they did amazing work. Since 2008 with my students, we've always run an exit poll, except 2020 with pandemic stuff. So we run an exit poll on election day. This year, students from my parties and elections class interviewed about 550 voters from across the second district, so it wasn't just in Northfield. We went to 14 precincts from South St. Paul down to Montgomery. The weather was not good. Students were cold, wet, and freezing, and they still managed to do a great job collecting survey responses from voters who had showed up at the polls. So it was really, really well done. Students already presented their results. We had a little public conference at St. Olaf, hosted by the Institute for Freedom and Community, and there were some really revealing findings. So, first off, this is not surprising, but Republicans and Democrats cared about very different issues. Mm-hmm. So when we asked what's the most important issue facing the nation today, Republicans talked about inflation mm-hmm. almost universally, and Democrats talked about abortion. And it was not even close. So Republicans and Democrats were really worried about different things. Now, I would say most political scientists don't think that issue voting is a thing. We kind of talked about this earlier with the importance of party ID. But there were some circumstantial evidence that it really mattered in 2022 in the case of abortion. Democrats were consistently opposed to the Dobbs decision. Mm-hmm. Without having the data in front of me, I think it was you know, over 90% of Democratic voters were strongly opposed to the decision. There was some splitting among Republican voters, and so that to me suggests that for Democrats, and we talk about the red wave that wasn't, you know, mm-hmm. And that for Democrats there was some potential to pull off some cross-pressured Republican voters who were a little bit ambivalent or who didn't like the Dobbs decision. So that's the second takeaway. Third, crime didn't matter the way that I think many analysts thought it would. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of crime ads that were being run. Mm-hmm. I would say in the second district, according to our polling results, very, very few voters listed it as the most important issue. It was just really low on the priority list. So crime doesn't pay, I guess, was the message from that. We talked a lot about religion, and we see the same religion in the survey. We see the same religious party differences that we kind of previewed earlier. However, interesting thing is when you control for abortion attitudes, mm-hmm. there are no religious differences between the parties. So in other words, if you were to bet me whether or not I could predict your vote choice, and I had one variable that I could use, mm-hmm. It would not be your religion. It would be how you felt about Dobbs. That was just highly predictive of vote choice. And that came through loud and clear in the survey. A couple other just kind of quick hitters from it. Mm-hmm. I would say Trump was on the ballot in 2022. Mm-hmm. So we asked, you know, it's really common in midterm elections. One of the things that you look at is incumbent party performance. And so, you know, all the social science research would say that 2022 is going to be a referendum on Joe Biden's performance as president. Yeah. And by that logic, that's why analysts were predicting a red wave. Biden's not very popular. Economy, consumer, you know, confidence was pretty low. But, you know, Trump is still part of the news cycle. Mm. And we asked two questions. So we asked, you know, do you agree with the job Joe Biden is doing as president, which is a really common sort of question that you ask on these surveys. We also asked, do you agree with the job President Trump did as president? So used kind of a parallel question wording. And that question, asking about Trump's performance, even though he hasn't been president for 2 years, mm-hmm. was just as predictive as Joe Biden, which is pretty fascinating. Now, this is also interesting. We talked about negative partisanship earlier. Yeah. Among those that voted for Angie Craig, only 21% strongly approved of Joe Biden it was a 4-point scale. So strongly approve, somewhat approve, somewhat disapprove, strongly disapprove. Only 21% were in the strongly approve category.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So not among Democrats, not a ton of enthusiasm for Joe Biden, but 87% strongly disapproved of Trump.
Do you have any sense what Biden's approvals ratings are in the second district?
I don't know in the second district. I mean, nationally it was floating right around 40%.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're kind of a bellwether district here. So this is about the same.
Okay. That's a really interesting, the fact that Trump, the direct reaction to Trump, that doesn't surprise me. But the fact that people can vote for Angie Craig but not be super happy with Joe Biden, that's interesting.
Yeah, and I could pull out the data set. I mean, you know, most Democrats fell in the somewhat approve category, mm-hmm. so that 21% was just the strong approval.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
But Democrats, you know, Democrats weren't there. They weren't right. totally on board with Biden.
Right.
You know, the final thing I would say is that, and this also fits with this idea of negative partisanship. Polarization is a thing. Voters in this survey were deeply divided. Everything I just said about issues mattered at the margins, but at the end of the day, nothing's more important than party ID. Party mm-hmm. ID predicted vote choice. And in fact, we asked a question about the national economy. We just said, has the national economy gotten better in the last 12 months? Nothing expressly partisan about that, right? We're not asking about an issue or about candidate performance.
Mm-hmm.
Among Democrats, 31% said that it had gotten better or somewhat better. Among Republicans, 97% said it had gotten worse or somewhat worse. So clearly, voters in the second district are perceiving the economy through partisan colored glasses.
That's just really... Joe, you've got a question.
I do.
I've got a follow-up question, too.
I thought there was a lot of reasons to fire the politicians in office this election cycle, inflation being at the top of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, when I saw that ruling, that Dobbs ruling come down in June, I personally thought that was going to change this election cycle.
Yeah,
I never believed in the red wave, certainly in places like Minnesota. But mm-hmm. after Dobbs, I thought that was a game changer from the day it came out. Did you have that same sense? Or
yeah, I did, in part because I've been doing this project with Paul Gorin for so long, and all the evidence we're seeing is that abortion and also gay rights are just different as issues. They're people are very, very passionate about them. They're more stable than most issue positions. People don't change their minds. And so so I really thought that it was going to matter. Another way that it matters that just doesn't show up in our survey data because we only looked at voters, but my guess is that it also mattered in a lot of ways in terms of turnout. Mm-hmm. You know, midterms have historically really poor turnout.
Mm-hmm.
You get a huge drop off from the presidential years.
Yeah.
And turnout in 2022 was strong, and my guess is that Dobbs also played a big motivating
mm-hmm.
role.
Mm-hmm. I'd be really interested to see how abortion as an issue is sort of perceived. Is it, I mean, at one point I think it was looked at as a policy issue. But how are people seeing abortion now as a civil right? I mean, is that maybe what we're talking about here?
I think that there are a lot of different ways
that
you can think about and frame abortion as a civil right, as basic health care.
Yep.
So I think, you know, and I think these are sort of the debates that we're going to,
and it,
to be
it,
having.
It is certainly seen from a religious point of view, too. I mean, that's the most fundamental seat of opposition to abortion is, you know.
Here's one other thing, you know, that's really interesting about it is, with most other issues, you know, you can kind of state your position on taxes,
mm-hmm.
right? But it doesn't necessarily have that. We talked about social identity earlier in this conversation. Taxes doesn't have that same sort of identity relevant component.
Right.
For abortion, we've actually got names. You're pro-life or you're pro-choice,
right?
It lends itself to these two social groups. And I think that really amplifies, you know, in some ways the tension that's mm-hmm. out there and the salience mm-hmm. of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just one more, just on your research. Was there anything that your data found that showed something a candidate said that might have pushed voters away, pushed voters to the other candidate?
In the second district, or, you know, I didn't have a great sense that there was any one thing. Like I said, I think probably Republicans invested more than they needed to in crime,
mm-hmm.
and which should have probably doubled down more on mm-hmm. on inflation, and also maybe responding to Democratic messaging on Dobbs.
Yeah. Agreed.
So
agreed.
If I had to give sort of like armchair quarterback, mm-hmm. you know, advice, that would have been it.
Sure.
Completely agree.
All right. This next question. I owe a debt of gratitude to Joe on this because he came up with this question, but he's letting me ask it because I've wanted to ask this question actually for a little while. First of all, I want to say I am a graduate of St. Olaf College with a degree in political science, and the what I know about the political science department today, you guys have taken, with no offense meant to the people who taught me 30 years ago, right? You guys have taken that department about 3 light years farther than it was 30 years ago. So thank you very much for the work you're doing. I say that as an alum. You were recently named in July as the Morrison Family Director of the Institute for Freedom and Community at St. Olaf College. This is the question I've always wanted to ask you. What is the Institute for Freedom and Community at St. Olaf College? And then what is your role as the director?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, in some ways, it's kind of like public policy this week, I think, in that we're committed to having meaningful conversations and a spirited yet informed exchange of ideas about meaningful public policy issues. Mm-hmm. That's really what the Institute exists to do, and to kind of, you know, sort of question easy answers, mix things up a little bit, yeah. like try to figure out, you know, get to seek truth, I guess, at the end of the day, which is you know, what college is there for. And so the Institute is hopefully gonna amplify some of the conversations that faculty are already having in the classroom by doing things like having workshops and bringing in guest speakers and so on and so forth. So, so that's what the Institute, exists to do. My role as director, is kind of multifaceted. One thing that we do is just create programming. And I'm working with faculty to decide, you know, who are we going to bring in as speakers? What type of programming do we need? How can we be creative in the way that we deliver programming? And the other thing that I think gets lost sometimes, but I think is just fundamentally important, is to teach students how to have these conversations, to really be an educator and to try to provide some scaffolding so that we can enter into these debates, these yeah. conversations in a way that that's going to be productive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If I may say so, I mean, I think that that framework right there is necessary throughout society. And if you can start with that framework on campus, that's just a fantastic place to begin, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's so...
I wish people had tried to teach me that when I was 20 years old.
Well, and it's even harder now, I think, you know, especially, I mean, for all of us, but I think especially mm-hmm. for young people, if you're reliant on a social media algorithm to give you your news,
yeah.
right? If,
yeah.
if we're looking at news that's coming right. up through Instagram or Twitter or whatever, and that's going to be your main news source, you're going to be pretty siloed. You're going to yeah. be, you know, exposed probably just to one side of an issue, and maybe demonizing the other side. And that makes it pretty tough to have an honest conversation.
Yeah.
And so, I think that just, you know, with the Institute, we're trying to do work to, you know, like I said, provide that scaffolding so that students can go into these conversations and have really healthy debates.
Yeah. Okay, Professor Chapp, give us some conclusionary thoughts, if you will, about our discussion today. Where is this headed, politics and religion? You know, simple question. Where's it headed? Will religious communication continue to impact politics? Is there anything we missed in this conversation?
No, I don't think there's anything that we missed. I mean, I would say nothing stays the same forever.
Right.
So we talked about a lot of big trends and big patterns, the importance of civil religion. We talked about the rise of religious nuns, and how that's connected to the nature of party coalitions. But nothing stays the same forever. So I think, you know, one thing we didn't talk about is we touched on it a little bit is the potential for some of this divisive rhetoric. I think that's mm-hmm. an important thing to an important ball for one to keep one's eye on. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the potential for sort of ethno-Christian nationalism, divisive rhetoric is troubling at this point. I didn't talk about it much because I think the levels are actually pretty low when I kind of look across all the candidates. But I think it's something that's important to think about. And I would also just continue to watch for connections between religion and what are often called culture war issues. So abortion, same-sex mm-hmm. relationship, mm-hmm. Rights for folks who identify as transgender, et cetera. These issues carry tremendous emotional weight, and as I've argued, they can influence religion as much as they are influenced by religion. And so those would just be some things to think about as a concluding thought.
That sounds like we need to do another show.
Yeah, it does. Maybe five or six more.
Plenty to talk about.
Yeah.
Let's wrap it up. Another great and interesting conversation, but let's end it here. Professor Chris Chapp, Rich and I want to thank you for the conversation and great insights this morning.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much. Please come back, Professor Chapp. That will conclude this week's edition of Public Policy This Week. We are on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1 each Friday morning from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock. I'm Rich Larson. My co-host today has been Joe Moravchik. Don't forget to join us next week when we discuss farming, specifically what are our Minnesota farmers doing to prepare for the planting season this coming season with our guests, Dave Legbold and Hannah Malika. And I have a feeling it's going to be Joe and I hosting that show again next week.
The objective for Public Policy This Week is to inspire important, meaningful, in-depth conversations about public policy challenges and opportunities, staying away from the high-volume, rhetoric-filled conversations that are so commonplace today.
Thank you for joining us today for Public Policy This Week. We'll be here again next Friday morning at 10 a.m. Have a fantastic Friday afternoon and a superb holiday weekend. Merry Christmas, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to Public Policy This Week. Tune in every Friday morning at 10 a.m. for more conversation with policy experts. Remember, this show can be found on your favorite podcast platform or stream it from kymnradio.net.